Welcome our speaker tonight, Bill from Roselle, New Jersey.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Bill Vizzozzi. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 15th, 2015. That's not to remind anyone how much time I do or don't have. That's to celebrate the day that I was set free from alcohol. I have a home group. It's The Way Out in Roselle, New Jersey. We meet Saturday and Sunday. Saturday nights we have a speaker meeting at 7. Sundays we have a big book meeting at 5. If you're ever around, we'd love to have you. I'm very grateful for my home group, for the examples that I've seen in that group, examples of the type of man I want to be. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time and had no idea what it was all about. You know, when I say what it was all about, I mean the program. I mean alcoholism. I raised my hand for 6 years, said, "Hi, my name is Bill and I'm an alcoholic." I have no idea what it means to suffer from alcoholism, right? I see my problem as everything on the outside. Everything on the outside is the problem. And so for 15 years, I'm drinking, I'm doing other things because alcohol has many forms. And I think whatever I'm out of control with is my problem at this current point in time. And for 15 years, it's like I'm playing that whack-a-mole game where you hit one and another one pops up. You hit one and another one pops up. And what I'm really doing is I'm treating my problem with another problem, whatever the case may be. And I'll worry about that next one when it becomes a problem, when that gets out of control. And it's exhausting. It's exhausting. But I wasn't in enough pain. I wasn't hopeless enough to be willing to take some action. So things really got out of control for me when I was 22 years old. I think the worst thing that could ever happen to an alcoholic, in my opinion, happened to me. And, you know, just a short disclaimer, this is all my experience. It's just my opinion. I don't speak for AA, I just speak for Bill. But so in my opinion, the worst thing that could ever happen to an alcoholic is to fall into some money. All right. 22 years old, I fell into $45,000 because of a workers' comp settlement. And that's bad news for me. Right. I had a drinking habit before I got this money. And it was responsible. When I say responsible, I mean I felt like I was having fun most times. I had some friends. I went to bed with money in my pocket at the end of most nights. And I felt like I could manage it. But as soon as I got this money overnight, it was like that same habit was not enough anymore. I didn't magically grow a tolerance overnight. The only difference was that I could now afford to get more. So I did get more, a lot more, and I got out of control with some things. I didn't know that I'm not like normal people, right? When I say normal people, you know, don't get offended. You probably know what I mean. You probably tried to be like them for a lot of years. Normal people like the ones who can go to the bar. They can order a drink. They drink half. They look at their watch and say, "Oh, it's time to go," and they walk away. Right? That's not normal to me. That's cruelty to alcohol. Right? Like, I paid $11 for that. If you don't finish it, I will. You're weird, right? Normal people, like, I tell this story a lot because it just still blows my mind. But if you want a glimpse of what a normal person is, I was out on a date with a girl. It was a blind date a couple of years ago. And we're out at the bar and we're talking. We start talking about drinking and drugs and stuff. And the date was in April. And she's talking about how some friends came over her house on New Year's. And they brought some cocaine. And it's still in her sock drawer. Like, that's not normal to me. To me, you're weird, right? New Year's, it would be 11:45 at night. I'd be licking the inside of that bag out, blowing people's phones up, cutting my tongue on someone else's credit card, right? That's not normal to me. But I have this abnormal reaction to alcohol, right? But it doesn't stop there. I also have this abnormal reaction to life as a whole, to people, to situations, to everyday tasks, right? Normal people can take out the trash stone cold sober every day. Millions of them do it every day. I have to be loaded, right? It talks in the book about how I look for the most trivial reasons to take a drink. Like, oh, stub my toe, you know? It doesn't take a lot for me to manufacture a reason to drink. And I don't know anything about what's going on, right? I think it's just whatever I'm out of control with. I think it's all this stuff on the outside. I think it's my money situation. I think it's the job I have. You know, if I could just get this much money, if I could just get this job or this car, I'm lonely. If I could just get this girl, you know, or if I could just get rid of this girl, you know. Thinking that all these things on the outside, if they were arranged properly, it would change the way that I felt inside, right? But I'm playing this whack-a-mole game, and nothing's getting better. Most of the times, I'm getting worse. You know, when I came to AA for 6 years, I heard a lot of this, don't drink and go to meetings. And that might work for some people, but for me, you know, don't drink and go to meetings is, you know, they say it a lot. It's like, how long can you hold your breath, right? Because if all I'm doing to get better is just not drinking, I'm not going to get better. Not an alcoholic of my variety. I'm going to get worse, right? What's it like when you hold your breath for a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and you finally let it go? That's what it's like when all I'm doing to get well is not drink. You know, I need to come up for air in the form of a drink. So I won't get into the details of my drunkalogue. I'm pretty sure I don't need to teach any of you how to drink. I'm pretty sure you all know how to do it so well that's why you're here. I went through all this money. I went through all the lines of credit, all the change under the couches, all the wallets that people left out, all the cars that I could rent out. I knew I had a problem. Right? I'm broke. I'm broke, that's my problem. So I need to go to rehab. Right? I've seen it in the movies. It works in the movie. It's got to work, you know. And I'm gonna go. And in the back of my mind, I'm just gonna get a tune up. I'm gonna get leveled out, and I'll be able to go back and do, you know, things normal, like it used to be. Not knowing, you know, because God forbid I pick up the big book. Not knowing that it says right there, the great delusion of every real alcoholic is to one day regain control and choice. Right? That's my great delusion. But I think I can get there. I think I can, if I just get enough time away from what I got out of control with, I can go back and I can do it normal. Because I'm a pretty smart guy, and I think that counts for something with alcoholism, and it doesn't. It doesn't. If anything, it hurts me, because I think I can think my way through a drink. So I go to rehab, and of course I'm not paying attention to anything they say, because I'm not like you. I'm not an alcoholic or a drug addict or whatever you want to call it. I'm not like, we're different, you know? So when they say something like alcoholics should not get romantically involved in treatment, you know, well, that's not me. Goes in one ear and out the other. You know, and I'm telling you, I fell in love in my first rehab. You laugh. We fell in love. It was love at first sight. I saw her in the med line. Our eyes locked. She would have cheeked her Suboxone for me. Right? And now that's love. If you don't think that's love, you don't know what love is. Right? And, you know, and we were going to be together, right? We wrote each other notes. We had a secret handshake. We knew where all the blind spots and the cameras were. We would hide behind them and kiss. And we were going to get out. We were going to get jobs. We were going to get, you know, live in an apartment together. We were going to keep each other sober, right? And so she got out before me. She got there after me and got out before me. I'm guessing I had better insurance. And so, you know, we get in this apartment, and look, I don't like to work hard for things. You know, I'm a big time planner. You know, I have a PhD in planning, but as far as putting things together to make it work, it's not my thing. You know, so I hit the least bit of resistance, and I just bail on whatever it is. So I get out. You know, I walk up and down the street. I maybe fill out one or two applications. I'm like, this isn't working out. I got to get out of here. This is not good for my sobriety, right? But 2 days ago, we were gonna keep each other sober, right? So I'm going to go in a halfway house, like an Oxford house, coincidentally closer to home, so I could, you know, maybe bring laundry home to mom and dad on the weekends. I made it there about a week before this girl I was running with, you know, before when I had all this money, came in there, and, you know, and I relapsed. And I wouldn't really call it a relapse, because I never unlapsed, right? But so now I know what the problem is, right? It's this girl. I gotta get far away from this girl. So I'm gonna do the most original Northeast thing ever. I'm gonna go to rehab in Florida. Right? You might have heard of people doing it. I was the first one. Right? But it's going to be different this time, right? Because I'm feeling really down on myself. I feel bad that I put all, you know, this whole 29 days together and I threw it right down the drain. So I'm going to take this seriously this time. And I had a game plan. I was going to be really down on myself, just focused, miserable all the time. We all right? All right. Sorry, I didn't mean to draw attention to you. I was just concerned. I feel like I did more harm than good there. There's another amends. So that's my game plan. I'm going to do this poor me thing. Everybody stay away from me so that I can stay focused on my recovery. And you ever hear when they say that it takes more muscles to frown than to smile? Right? Like being miserable purposefully, you know, consciously is exhausting. It's exhausting. And you know, I made it a few days, and I don't remember what happened. Maybe somebody said something funny, or somebody complimented me, but I smiled. I smiled, and someone came up to me, and they noticed that I was smiling. They said, "Hey, look at you, man. You're really coming around. You're showing good progress." And I'll be damned, that felt good, right? And so you're going to notice a theme tonight, that the history of my life, when I find something that feels good, I want more. Doesn't matter what it is. I don't know if that's just me. But so I wanted more. Right? And so what was this that I was getting? It was attention, right? Behind these walls where I'm safe from all those things that I used to burn my life to the ground, I'm using your attention to get relief. And so I, you know, how can I get more? Well, if I pretend like I'm getting better, I'll get more of this good attention, right? Sound like a slogan we throw around sometimes? Fake it till you make it? It doesn't work. It doesn't work. I'm telling you, you know, it might work. It did not work for me. I'm telling you, because I faked it and I had all this phony momentum, right? I was doing great. They made me community leader, you know, like the president of rehab. It's like being the smartest kid on the short bus. And I had all this phony momentum and I got out there and I had no idea what was really wrong with me. I had no idea how to get my feet moving in the real world. And I was doomed from the start, right? An alcoholic of my type without a solution. If all I'm doing to get well is not drink, I'm a ticking time bomb. It's only a matter of time until I take a drink, you know? And this, honestly, the sooner I do, the better. Nowhere in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, does it say don't drink. In fact, it says the opposite. It says if you think you don't have this problem, go try some controlled drinking. Go drink, please. Because if it doesn't kill you, it'll make you willing, right? That's a fact. And so So, you know, I stayed in a halfway house down in Florida for a few months. I couldn't take it. I wasn't getting well. I came back to Jersey. I made it about 2 weeks here, and I thought I was where I needed to be, right? I thought I was ready to go back to being normal. And so I was out for 3 years. I was out for 3 years. It did more damage in those 3 years than the first 12. When I literally, in those 12, I was saying to hell with everything. Did more damage. I got my first and only DUI. Right, I said I drove better drunk. That wasn't my opinion. Look at my driving history. Every accident I've ever been in, I was sober. Sober's the issue here. Right? That's evidence. So I don't even remember getting in the car that night. I crashed into a guardrail going 45 miles an hour. And it's scary that I still don't remember getting in the car. Because you know the fog gets lifted and you get some time away and things start to come back. You still to this day don't remember getting in that car. And so I have a couple fight or flight responses that kick in when I get into a jam like that. The first thing I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to run away, right? So I'm looking around. I'm about 20 miles from home, but the area I'm in, it looks very familiar to this town next over from where I live. I think I'm only about 2 miles from home, so I could probably walk, and I could probably just say that somebody stole this car, you know, and I'll worry about it later. But I made it about 20 feet, collapse, concussion, all the drinks. All right, can't run. Let me get somebody else to bail me out because I don't want to be accountable for my own actions. Let me call Dad. Hey, Dad, can you come get me? Yeah, sure, no problem. Where are you? I'm like, Perth Amboy, you know, 2 miles from home, and I'm actually 20 miles from home. He's like, all right, sure, I'll be right there. He's driving around 2 a.m. for an hour looking for his son in a car that ain't there, you know, thinking maybe I got peeled off the road already. All right, that didn't work, right? Maybe now I'll go check on my friend in the passenger seat who shattered his pelvis, right? Maybe now. That me, then if I'm bored, maybe you. Next thing I did while I was out, I robbed my father for 1.5 years and blamed it on my mother. Right? No big deal. Just the woman who carried me around for 9 months and taught me how to read. You know, I feel bad about the terrible things I do, don't get me wrong, after I do them. If I felt bad before or during, I might not even do them. But the great news is I feel so bad after I do something terrible like that. The only way to make that bad feeling go away is to drink. Right? So it's just feeding itself. It's seen, my lifestyle is feeding itself. The last thing I did while I was out, I took a job. Everybody always gets a kick out of this. I don't know why. I took a job running a liquor store. Well, I was running it into the ground. My title was store manager, but day drinking took on a whole new meaning now because this is work. I've got to know how to sell this. I've got to know what it tastes like. I've got to know different ways to prepare it and combine it. You know, flavor profiles and all that stuff. Well, don't compromise my integrity by making me lie and tell you, oh, it's really good and I've never tried it. You know? So, of course, I'm not getting loaded at 10 in the morning. I'm working. So, December 4th, 2015, the best thing that ever happened to me happened. Right? And I have a different view today. Of things that happen pre-sobriety, of like what's a good thing and what's a bad thing, right? Like, you would think for a normal person, coming in that money at 22 years old would be a good thing, but it was the worst thing that could ever happen to me, right? Because all those good things that happened to me along the way, all they did was encourage my lifestyle. I could live this way, and eventually good stuff will happen once in a while. I could live with that. But it was things that were really bad that were actually really great. Anytime I got in trouble, anytime I got locked up, anytime I really hurt somebody and felt terrible about it, all those things, all that pain that built up eventually led to me being willing, you know? So the best thing that ever happened to me on December 4th, 2015 was I got fired from this job. Some money went missing, $580. I didn't take it. You don't have to believe me. You know, I would have liked to think for a long time that if I was going to steal from work, that it would have been a lot more, you know, because I'm a cat burglar. But the reality is I would have stole a roll of quarters from you if it meant getting a drink. But I didn't take the money. So I couldn't use the excuse that, look, I didn't rob you, I would have taken a lot more. So I went quietly. When my life as a whole takes a turn for the worse, I try to come up with a big idea to get me out of everything, right? All the years, I think that just one big idea is going to fix everything. And I've had some good ones over the years, right? When I was 17, I wanted to become a priest. Crickets. When I was 19, I wanted to become a police officer. When I was 23, I tried to fake my own death. I went pretty far. I took it pretty far. I wandered into a hospital in Manhattan, and I walked into the emergency room, and I said, "I need to see a doctor." And they said, "Okay, sure. What's your name?" And I said, "I don't know." And so that was going to be my game. I was going to play the amnesia thing. You know, I figured that was a good way to get off the grid. You know, start fresh. I don't know what my end game was. I was going to join some bank robbery crew or something, But I made it a night in the hospital. I got a free MRI courtesy of State of New York. I woke up the next morning and I said, "I gotta get out of here. I'm bored, you know." And so I said, "Nurse, I'm leaving." She said, "No, you can't leave. You don't know who you are." And I said, "I'm Bill Bozzozzi. I'm getting the F out of here, you know." I hop the train home. I go home and nobody thinks I'm dead, right? I staged a phony crime scene. I kicked the front door open. There was blood in the kitchen. Real blood, I told you, I took it far. But nobody thought I was dead. Why? Because I left the laptop open with the Google search, "How to fake your own death." Criminal mastermind. So I've got a track record of having really good ideas. So I lose this job at the liquor store, and my great idea now is I'm going to do what normal people do when they lose their jobs. Right? I'm going to take a vacation. Right? I lose my source of income. Let me blow the rest of what I got. If I'm going to start over, I'm going to start from zero. You know? So I'm going to go to Florida and I'm going to go see an old girlfriend. I'm 29 at the time. I'm going to go see this girl that I dated when I was 19. I put this girl through a lot of pain. You know, I lied to her. I cheated on her. I took advantage of her hospitality, her kindness. You know, I never live up to the me that she thought I could be. But after all that, she would still pick up the phone when I called, right? She would still have a nightmare where something bad happened to me. She would call me in the morning and say, is everything all right? I just want to make sure it wasn't a premonition or something. You know, I'm worried. And so in my mind, if all this has taken place, if I could hurt you that much and you still want to hear the sound of my voice, we're soulmates, right? We're soulmates. It's like that saying, if you throw a seashell away and it comes back, it's meant to be. I threw that seashell away like 12 times and it kept coming back. You know, so my big idea is I'm going to go down to Florida. I'm going to see this girl and I'm going to ask her to marry me right off the plane. This girl I haven't seen in 10 years. And I'm telling you, in my mind, it was going to fix everything. It's going to fix everything. I even got Mom involved. I said, hey, Mom, can I borrow your engagement ring? She says, how do you borrow an engagement ring? I said, it's easy, Mom. If she says no, you can have it back. Right? And she's always co-signing my BS. She says, sure, why don't you go get it polished? So I go down to Florida. I got to rent a car to get around. I don't have a lot of money. Remember, I didn't take the money. That's my story. And so I'm going to rent a little economy car, like a Kia or something. So I'm walking in the Enterprise Garage parking lot, and I see this 2016 silver Mustang convertible. Right? And I remember that this girl, when we dated, she loved Mustangs. The color silver, convertibles, you know. It was a sign. God may as well have dropped that car right out of heaven and said, rent me. You know, I knew if I could somehow get in that car, she might not say no. Right? I don't know about yes, but she might not say no. So I asked the girl at Enterprise, I say, what's up with this car? She's like, oh, it's this much, you know, $55 a day or something. I'm like, I don't have that much. She's like, well, how much do you have? I'm like, I got like $150, you know. And I'm thinking in my mind, what I lack in money, I make up for with a great story. You don't have to know it's true because my trade is selling lies. And so so I say, are you sure there's nothing you can do? Because I'm here to ask my girlfriend to marry me, you know. And she says, how long have you and your girlfriend been together? And I think pretty quick on my feet. I got a number in my head. I haven't seen you in 10 years. We've been together 10 years. She says, oh, do you know where you're going to do it yet? I'm thinking to myself, I don't even know where she lives. Right? I just came up with this idea yesterday. And I'm like, no, I haven't quite figured it out yet. And she says, let me talk to a manager. I'll see what we can do. She comes back. She says, I got good news for you. We're going to let you rent this 2016 silver Mustang convertible for the same price as that low key over there. $12 a day, right? So I'm rolling in my 5.0, my ragtop down so my hair can't blow. And it's December in Fort Lauderdale, 75 degrees. I asked this girl to marry me like 3 times. She only laughed once, right? But she knows my style. She knows my speed, my routine, that I get these big ideas. I don't want to put any work in. She's like, well, what's your plan? I'm like, my plan's to marry you. You know? She's like, I'm dating myself with that gesture, but it's cool. She's like, that's not a plan. You got no job, no car, no place to live. I said, slow down. I'm going to live right here with you. She said, no. You got to get your own place to live, your own job, your own car. And I'm thinking, like, this sounds like a lot of work. Right? Like, I did the hard work. I came up with the idea. You know, can't you do everything else? So I've already abandoned it, you know, bailed on it in my head. But I got 2 days there, and I still want her to let me sleep on her couch. So I said, if I do all that stuff, then can we have this conversation? And she says, yeah, sure. So the next day, she goes to work, and I got to find something to do. And I'm going to talk for a few minutes about what happened next, because it's very strange what happened next. Very strange for a number of reasons. Strange because I was feeling pretty good about my life, even though my life was terrible. You know, I wasn't feeling particularly bad about it. You know, I figured, you know, I'll go home to Mom and Dad, I'll live rent-free, you know, and I'll get another crappy job, and things will work themselves out like they always do. You know, I'll just continue to be a leech on my parents and my family and society, really. So I don't feel bad, you know. My drinking wasn't as out of control as it had ever been, you know. And the biggest reason why it's weird what I did next is because I had walked away from Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Guilt-free, you know. I did my dissertation. Right? It doesn't work. Either it doesn't work, period, or it just won't work for me because I'm just so damn different. Right? I listened. I paid attention. I memorized the whole chapter out of your book. You know, and I went up there and read how it works, and I looked you right in the eye, and I said it, and I thought I was cool. I thought I was impressing you. It's like reading a cookbook and thinking you're not going to be hungry anymore. Right? There's stuff in there I got to do if I want to get those results, if I want to, you know, if I want to fill the emptiness in my belly. Right? So it was very weird that I went to an AA meeting that day after walking away from it for 3-4 years. And God, it was just like I remember it. I didn't believe any of you people. There is no way you're sober. There's no way you're sober and happy, right? It's either one or the other. And if you're happy, I'm going to need you to pee in this cup. Because I don't believe you. Nobody said anything profound. We didn't read anything out of the book that that I heard. And I was like, oh, that's me. That's me right there. That didn't happen. You know, I'd like to tell you it was a moment like that, but it wasn't. But there was an area out back after the meeting where people would go and they would smoke. And so I'm sitting out there and I'm hanging out with some people. I start talking to this older man. His name was Chuck. He was about 75 years old. He had those real thick Coke bottle glasses. He was dressed like some vacuum cleaner salesman from 1960 with his skinny black tie and a short sleeve white button. I remember it clear as day. And we start talking. He says, hey, let me ask you something. Do you have a car? I'm like, oh, I got a car. Yeah, I got a car. He's like, can I have a ride? I don't live far. If you can, it's no big deal. I'm like, yeah, sure, man, no problem. We get out to the parking lot, and he says, ooh. I said, this is us, Chuck. He says, ooh. He's petting the fender and everything. And he sits in the front seat, and I turn to him, and I say, hey, Chuck, you mind if I put the top down? Right? And this is my ego grasping for life right here. Because I don't care if you mind if I put the top down. Right? I'm just trying to show off this stranger that I just met that I'll never see again with this car that I lied my way into. Right? That's how much I need your acceptance and your attention. I'll just take it in such a small dose like that. That's why I say, hey, Chuck, you mind if I put the top down? And as the top come down, I could see the sun hit his face, and this old man starts to cry. He'd been on this planet for 75 years, never been in a convertible before. Right? And something came over me. I don't know why. I don't know where it came from, but I put my hand on his shoulder, and I said, God is good. Right? I didn't even know why I was saying what I said, but I felt something right there. Right? You know, and from here on out, most of what I'm going to tell you is things that I learned after the fact, because I didn't put it all together right away. You know, but that was a spiritual experience. It was sudden and profound. You know, it sparked something in me. But it made me feel good what happened right there, that moment that he had and that I was able to share in it with him. I found out what that was. It was helping someone else without expecting anything in return. Turns out I'd never done it before. You know, 29 years, you would have think I'd at least done it by accident. And it also turns out that in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the most important thing we do, right? And it's hidden in plain sight. The 12th step, the fifth tradition, in a nutshell, we help others, right? Most important thing we do. But I was listening all those years I went to AA. You know, I guarantee you, if you're listening, you're not going to miss the most important part of something. So when we talk about throw out your old ideas, I got a free one right there. Because I thought I was listening, and clearly I wasn't, you know? So quickly, right away, you know, there was some other guy walking out. He's like, hey, can I get in? I'm like, get in, man. He was some Iraqi refugee, you know, and I took him to Burger King and he ordered a Big Mac and I let it slide. And it was cool, you know, but I was like, there's only so much of this I can do. There's only so many old, you know, old guys I can give rides to. I got to go home, you know, but I was fortunate enough that I got connected with some people that I remember from when I was in treatment and halfway in Florida. And I said, something's going on, man. Something's going on. I feel different, right? And I know I've said that before, you know, and I've said it's going to be different this time, but this time it actually felt different, you know? And anybody who knew me, they gave me that cautiously optimistic look, you know, like, that's great, man. Cool. You know, we'll see what happens, you know? Like, call me when you fall off your pink cloud, you know? And fortunately, I was not like Ebby. I did not leave Young's office before I even got on the boat, got loaded. I got in touch with a man who was armed with the facts about himself. And he started talking to me about these spiritual principles. He started talking to me about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and why this all works, right? At its core, it works because of one alcoholic sharing with another, right? And so he talked to me about alcoholism. You know, he helped me understand why I didn't get well when all I was doing was putting down the drink. He talked to me about this emptiness in my soul, right? That it's not a disease. No more than hunger, thirst, tired is a disease, right? The only thing is I'm not doing the right things to fill it, right? Let's take hunger, for example. Let's all agree that hunger is an emptiness in my belly. You know, if I don't fill it properly, I'm going to have a chemical imbalance. My body's not going to feel nourished. Right? If I eat stones, I'm not going to, you know, get energy and you know, build muscles. But and it's okay to have stones, you know, but they're not intended to fill the emptiness in my belly. You know, it's okay to have a nice car, but I wouldn't eat my car, right? I was very fortunate that at a very young age, people in my life taught me how to fill this emptiness in my belly. Unfortunately, there was no one there, or at least no one I was willing to listen to, who taught me how to fill the emptiness in my soul until I started talking to this man. And he talked to me about, you know, that the emptiness in my soul needs to be filled with God's love and helping others, right? And the best way to accomplish that is through the 12 steps, right? And they're not like hurdles that I jump over and they're done. They're more like these guardrails that keep me in line for the rest of my life. You know, they're instructions on how to live by these spiritual principles like honesty, hope, faith, integrity, willingness, humility. Humility is great. You know, I cried during my seventh step because I said, I don't know anything. You know, that was a liberating experience. You know, and in the fifth step, I learned that I have this life that's run by fear, right? Hundreds of forms of fear, but it's all fear. And for years, I don't know where I heard it, but they said the opposite of fear is faith, right? But the opposite of fear is love, right? Because when I'm living by my will, I'm living a life run by fear. And when I'm living by God's will, I'm living a life run by love. Hundreds of forms of love, you know, compassion and respect and dignity. So I was taken through the steps pretty quickly. I didn't ask to be taken through them quickly. I wasn't told to be taken through them quickly. I was asked, how much action are you willing to take? How much freedom do you want? Right? If you only want half the freedom, you only have to take half the action. But if you take all the action, you'll have all the freedom, all the happiness, all the gifts that life has to offer, inside and outside Alcoholics Anonymous. Does that sound like something you're interested in? Yeah. And so in my mind, you know, there were either two possibilities, right? Either he's full of crap, right? In which case, if he's full of crap, I get to be right, and I get to go back to doing what I like to do, drink, you know? If he's right, you know, then I get to be happy and free without alcohol. And that's a pretty cool thing. That's something that I can never wrap my head around, because I thought in one way or another that I would always at least have the option to drink. You know, what does my life look like without it, right? Because when I talk about I get worse when all I'm doing to get well is not drink, worse always looks different. Worse looks like bored, depressed, anxious, irritable, restless. Discontent is a great word. Like generally unhappy with anything and everything that I have at any given moment in time. Yep, that's me. You know, lonely. Lonely is something I was hard to admit for a while, but I was lonely, right? You know, they talk about when you feel alone in a crowded room. It's because my behavior, these substances, the drink, puts distance between me and my fellows, puts distance between me and God. But that's why I feel alone in a crowded room. You know, I never got what people meant when they said I wasn't comfortable in my own skin. Like, whose skin would you be comfortable in? That's gross. You know, like, but then I heard someone say it. She said, I felt like a wet cat. And I was like, I get that. You know, that's me. I'm a wet cat. You know, if all I'm doing to get well is not drink, it's not good. I'm just, get them off of me. You know, so like I said, I got taken through these steps quickly because I was willing to take action. And 4 weeks, roughly, it took me to finish my steps. And I had the obsession to drink removed in 3 weeks. And once it's removed, it never comes back, right? That's the deal. That's the way it works. Because who's removing it? God's removing it, right? If you abandon yourself to God, abandon is another great word in our book. You know, you always think of abandon as like an abandoned house or something. You never really think about the definition of the word. It means to cease to care for yourself, right? Well, I don't want to. Why am I going to not care about myself, right? Well, because God's caring about me now. God's taking care of me. You know, I got a really good friend. He puts it real great. He says, I help God's kids and God helps me. You know, he's like, I didn't make a deal with God, but that's kind of the unspoken arrangement we have. You know, and that's what I found to be true in my life, in my life in sobriety. You know, and then I get to make these amends, which, you know, I have some horror stories of amends. You know, it's not all sunshines and rainbows. It's not all, I'm just glad you're doing well. You know, those are the only ones we hear about, you know, not the ones where, you know, you slept with your best friend's girlfriend and you had to make amends to both of them and he wouldn't even talk to you and you made amends to her and then she asked you out to dinner and then you're like, what? You know, because there's an opportunity to create more harm there. You know? So I define my life, you know, today two ways. You know, in drinking, I thought it was all about what I've been through, right? Dad beat mom, you know, had cancer. All these people died, you know. Well, poor me. Everybody look at me, you know, not realizing that victims stay sick and villains get well, right? But in sobriety, I define my life by my amends, you know. I hope most of us know that amends doesn't mean saying I'm sorry, right? The word amend means change. You know, I am sorry. I feel terrible about what I've done. But it's a promise to that person, to God, and to myself that I'm never going to do that to you again. That I'm never going to do that to anybody again. Because nobody deserves to get treated that way. Right? And I make enough of these amends and I get to eliminate all these behaviors out of my character. And it's great. It's great and it's jarring. Because, you know, 29 years and I drew conclusions about myself, right? Like you have experience doing some things for an extended period of time. Like you play a bunch of sports and you do really well. Oh, I'm a good athlete, you know? You sing songs and you get a record. I'm a good singer, you know? Like based on your experience, you draw conclusions about yourself. Well, based on my experiences, based on my inability to put down the drink, despite the fact that most times I knew it was a bad idea, at every phase in it, before I went to get it, after I got it, while I was doing it, the next morning, I knew it was a bad idea, but I still kept doing it. Right? I'm fighting this craving beyond my mental control. I don't know it, but I am. But so all I see is the behavior. And I think, what would you classify that behavior as? What type of person exhibits that type of behavior? A stupid person. Right? So 29 years, first conclusion is that I'm stupid. Right, then let's look at the way I treat people. Right, I lie, cheat, steal, just do terrible, hurtful things to people that I care about, people that care about me. You know, and I say I'm sorry. I say I won't do it again. I say it'll be different this time. Hook me up to a lie detector. I'm telling the truth. Right, but enough time goes by, and I do it again to you. Maybe I do it to someone else. Right, there's no change. Yeah. And so, you know, what's the conclusion there? What type of person exhibits that type of behavior? I'm a piece of garbage. 29 years, I have all the evidence I need based on my experiences that I'm stupid and I'm a piece of garbage. What a relief when I found out that I'm just an alcoholic, right? That I have this emptiness that needs to be filled. And I'll use any human power I can get my hands on to try and fill it, right? Preferably the drink, because it works. You know, problem is that it's temporary, right? And I need more as time goes on to get to the same level of effect. You know, a pint to a liter to a handle, a 6 to a 12 to a 30, whatever it is you were doing, I guarantee you, you needed more to get to the same place as time went on. You know, if that's not your experience, then we can talk afterwards and you can tell me what the hell it is you're doing. But you know, it's temporary. And there's price tags, there's consequences. Right, there's the obvious financial price tags, there's emotional price tags, social price tags. You know, I lose friends. I don't want to be around certain people because they don't, you know, like my lifestyle. They can't keep up with me. You know, there's physical price tags. You know, liver disease, to name the least. You know, my body just withers away. I'm 165 pounds. I look in the mirror. I can see all my ribs, and I think I look good. Right? I deteriorate mentally. Right? Aliens land in my backyard. They come down in a bolt of lightning, right? They take over the bodies of all the people who lived on the street behind me. And for 2 weeks, I didn't know who I could trust because the whole street was aliens with human skin suits. I'm withering away. The SWAT team's coming to my house every 15 minutes. There's not even a SWAT team in my town, but they're coming. They're coming with the battering ram. They're gonna bypass the front door, go right to my bedroom door. I'm withering away in all aspects, right? It's price tags, consequences, but I don't care about them because I need relief so bad. I need to fill this emptiness so bad, right? I don't care what it takes to fill it. I don't care who I have to run through or walk over to get to it, right? It doesn't care how much I love you, how much I say I care about you. If you get in the way of me feeling good, you're over. You're over. It doesn't matter. You know, and that's the way I run through life. That's no way to treat people. But I don't care. You know. So I make, you know, I make these amends, and I get to change. You know, that's how I stay stopped. Because I had to change. That's how I get well. I had to change. I had to change who I was inside, from the inside out. You know, all that stuff on the outside wasn't gonna make me feel right. But you know, we say it all the time. It's an inside job. But it's true. You know, when I start working here, everything out here gets better, right? And amazing things happen. You know, but I gotta get my feet moving. I gotta get my feet moving. I gotta keep them moving. I gotta remember what got me here. Not like remember the pain. Remember all the action I took to get this happy and this free and keep doing it, right? Like, so I was just telling Tom, I was out in Florida and I was visiting some family, which is great, you know, because I have a job, because I'm employable today. Crazy things, I promise you, crazy things happen when you get sober and start doing the right things. People want you to work for them, you know? I'm in good standing with my employer. I have vacation days. Oh my gosh, if you told me 2 years ago that I have a 9-to-5 and vacation days, I would have, you know, my head would be spinning. But because of this action, I have the opportunity to go down there and see some family, right? Thursday night, someone says, you know, let's, you know, my girlfriend says, you know, want to go to a meeting. And so we go to this meeting, and it was a beginner meeting. You know, they do the normal, you know, less than a year shares for their first half hour, and then the rest they open it up. And so once they open it up, it was just 3 minutes of silence. And I normally don't like to share, you know, because I can quickly make it all about me. You know, and my ego, and how you got to hear what I'm, you know, you need to hear what I have to say. But no one was saying anything, and I raised my hand, I shared for 2 minutes. Someone came up to me after the meeting and said, "Hey, can you come back and speak on Sunday?" You know, and I said, "Yes," right? Not to satisfy my ego. I honestly, like, this is my least favorite part of Alcoholics Anonymous at this point in my sobriety. I would so much rather spend this hour sitting down one-on-one with another man or woman, whoever's willing and needs help and has no other help available to them. I'm here for them. But I would so much rather do that than this. But this is a part of the deal, and I have to say yes to AA when I'm asked. It's what got me here. I have to remember what got me here. You know. So when Jeff asked me in March, I said yes. When this man Mike asked me in Florida, I said yes. You know. And so 3 months sober, when someone said, "I think you should get your own commitment," like not a coffee commitment, not a chair commitment, not a, you know, a greeter commitment, like go find a treatment center that needs a message and go in there and bring it, right? And so I did that. I said yes, you know, and this group, I mean, I'm so grateful to this group because, you know, we keep our feet moving. We're in treatment centers, we're in Salvation Armies, you know, we're in the trenches, you know, we're on the firing lines, and we're safe and protected by this power of love that I call God, you know. And so I started, you know, when I started, it was 3 times a week at this detox. And then I got a job, you know, so I had to cut it back. But it's like, I still go there once a week, you know, and I've been there for over a year now. And it's the highlight of my week to be able to sit down. They only have 8 beds there, but to sit down with these 7 or 8 people and share my experience, you know, the most important thing I have to offer is my time. You know, the most valuable thing I have to offer. It's the only thing I can't get back, you know. And so I have this experience now, experience of what to do. You know, I had 29 years of experience of what not to do, of what definitely does not work, right? But I have some experience, a little bit at that, of what works, you know, with the solution. You know, and I've been able to see through this process, through these principles, that my most humiliating experiences are now my greatest gifts to share, right? I always think about it like, so when I did this fourth step, it's like I'm carrying around like a bag of bricks, right? And it's all the terrible things I've done, all the ways I think people wronged me. And it's heavy, you know, it's heavy. I'm just wearing it through life, and it's like, it's painful just to exist, right? But I do this fifth step, and I lay all my bricks out on a table, and magically God comes in and waves his hand over, and all these bricks turn into bars of gold, right? So why would I hold anything back in a fourth and fifth? Why wouldn't I let it all out there? You know, if it's all going to become a gift now that I get to share, the more I have to share, the more helpful I get to be. The more helpful I get to be, the better I get to feel, right? Because this is why I do it, because it fills the emptiness inside of me. It makes me feel good. If it didn't work, I wouldn't do it. I have a very short attention span for things that don't work, right? 3 or 4 minutes, if it's not working, I'll move on to something else. And so I've been able to sponsor other men. You know, and share my experience with them with these principles. And there's no better feeling than to get to watch the light come on in someone else's eyes. I know it's a cliched, you know, term, but it's what happens. You know, they have this awakening. They just get to be full of this love, you know, this power of love. That's why I go through these steps. That's why I, you know, get connected with this power of love. Bill talks about it. He says, power of love, superhuman strength, and direction. You know, when he's talking about how that's the God he couldn't wrap his head around. He's like, I could get intelligent design, you know, all these stars and just the right places, you know, and man being made and all that, but this God of love, superhuman strength, and direction, I just can't wrap my head around, you know. And I was hung up on God because I had a religious upbringing, and I thought I knew God. I thought God was, you know, a man in clouds with a long beard waving a big finger telling me what to and not do, you know. And that's not the case. I don't know what God looks like. I'm pretty sure I'm not supposed to know what God looks like. You know, if I was supposed to know what God looks like, he, she, it would have revealed itself to me by now. But I know God's expression, his love, right? And so I get connected to God through these principles. I get connected to this power of love that makes me better at helping others, right? And I get to carry this message, right? Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That's the guaranteed result. If it didn't happen, then you weren't honest and thorough like it asks. You know, if you balk at any point in this process, you know, it says that some of these we may balk. At none of these can we balk. You know, because if I balk at any point in this process, it's all going to fall apart. If I balk on one, it's going to fall apart. If I get all the way to 11 and I balk on that, it's going to fall apart. I had a big problem with 11, with prayer and meditation, you know, because I didn't know how to talk to God without asking for stuff. Right? I didn't know how to pray for other people. I didn't know how to pray for myself so that I could be more helpful to other people. But so I keep my prayer real simple, right? You know, in the morning I say, show me what you want me to do today. And at night I say, thank you. You know, because if I get too involved, you know, if I start talking for too long with God and be like, you know, some air conditioning in the car would be nice. I'm not, you know, making demands, but, you know, I could help a lot more guys if I had air conditioning in the car. Meditation I had a big problem with, right? Because I have that racing mind. It's moving 1,000 miles a minute. I'm thinking about other things. And so someone made the mistake of giving me some terrible meditation advice years ago. They said, if you want to meditate, you go out in the field and you just start counting the shades of green. And by the time you lose count, you'll be at peace. Right? I don't think they knew how high I could count. Right? Because I got to well over 1,000. And I was just more frustrated with, is this color like the one 300 ago? You know, I was not at peace. I was not at peace. You know, and so without even knowing that, you know, because that's the way God works, my sponsor gave me very simple instructions this time around on how to meditate. He said, Bill, when you were in school, when you were younger, did you have a crush on a girl? Ever? I said, yeah, of course. Yeah, sure. He's like, did you think about her all the time? I'm like, yeah. He's like, you were meditating. All right. Now I just want you to go out there and change the subject to love and helping others, to patience and tolerance, right? So by that rationale, I can do it all the time. I can do it while I'm driving, you know? It's actually a great suggestion to do it while you're driving, to practice patience and tolerance, especially in New Jersey, you know? But that's how I redirect my thinking, you know? And 10th step is great. You know, the 10th step, there's clear instructions on the 10th step. It says that we watch out for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, right? And so to me today, that's the first drink, right? A selfish act, a lie, you know, a resentment, a fear. That's the first drink, because if I leave that unchecked, it's always going to lead to a drink. It's going to start a chain of events, right? I love, you know, all the chains of events that we can look at, you know, because there was a letter, you know, Carl Jung. Bill wrote a letter to Carl Jung in the 60s, basically letting him know, you know, thanks, you know, I don't know if you know this, but you set in motion this process that led to this worldwide fellowship we have now. You know, when you told Roland he was hopeless, you know, and then he got drunk, and then he went to Ebby, and Ebby went to Bill, you know, and this all happened. And so he wanted to say thank you. And so Carl Jung wrote back to him, and he said, man, I sugarcoated it when I told Roland how hopeless he was, right? He was screwed, you know? And I knew I was going to get laughed out of my profession for telling him to go to these Oxford groups where they were having the success. You know, but he cared for the man. You know, just like God bless Dr. Silkworth, because he's so close, right? When he's talking about psychic change, he's talking about a spiritual awakening, right? He's so close, but he can only use the words that he understands, right? He can only get so close without actually being one of us, right? So this remarkable chain of events that led to this fellowship, this remarkable chain of events that led to me being here tonight, right? Think about all the things that had to happen just the right way for me to get somewhere I wasn't planning on being, you know? And we could just go from right before I got sober. We could go with this money going missing. What if they found it? Because I didn't take it. What if they found the guy who took it? You know? What if they didn't put it on me? Right? What if mom didn't give me this ring? Right? Or she's like, you're out of your mind. I'm not giving my engagement ring. You know? What if this girl wasn't working at Enterprise that day? You know? What if that Mustang wasn't in that lane? You know? What if this maniac of a woman was even an even bigger maniac than me and said yes to marrying me? You know? Which, you know, I'll just... If you haven't figured out, that didn't happen. You know? Everybody always comes up, so did you get married? Like, no, are you kidding me? Like, you know, what if this old man wasn't at that meeting that day? You know, he was pretty old. He could have died. You know, he could have taken the bus. All those things that had to happen just the right way. I couldn't have planned it. It's God's will. You know? And so I enjoy my life so much that I gifts of the program, gifts of God, right? The way that I feel about myself, the way that I can participate in relationships, not just romantic relationships, but simple friend relationships where, like, you talk and I listen. It's new for me, I'm telling you, because you would talk and my head would be all the way over there, you know, or I would be thinking about what I'm going to say next, you know, or about how what you're saying is stupid, you know. I can't participate in a normal relationship, right, where there's a common goal and open line of communication, right? I have just incapable. And no wonder why I have no one that's close to me. No wonder why I'm so lonely, right? No wonder why I want to isolate. And thank God that I was in enough pain, that I was willing to ask for help and accept the help when it was being offered to me. You know, because that's a whole other thing, accepting the help when it's being offered to me. You know, I'll ask you for help, and you could offer it to me, but I'm not doing all of it, you know? Like, if, you know, I might do a couple of those things, but it's help on my terms, not help on help's terms, you know? And so that's fine. That's fine, because guess what? For it to work for me, it doesn't have to work for you, right? All I have to do is be honest and open and share my experience with love. And then I'll come alive. You know, I'll walk out of here feeling 1,000 times better than when I got here, no matter how good I was feeling when I got here. That's the way it works, right? All I can do is make this stuff available. I got real twisted. Where is it? Fifth tradition says each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message. See, when you said carry, I heard shove down your throat, right? I was on this evangelical thing, doing hostile takeovers on meetings, telling you everything you did wrong. You know, these speaker destruction meetings where you come in here, you're talking about how the cat pooped on the rug and the heated seats in the Mercedes won't work, and I would just come in here and lay some real problems on you, you know? But that's not the way this works. That's not patience, love, and tolerance, right? So I make my experience available to you, you know? If you think you got what I got, you know, and you're willing to do whatever it takes, you're willing to take some action, then let's go, right? Take my hand and let's go, because we are having a lot of fun. You know, we are living happy and free. Free. That was the biggest kick in the butt. That all this is free. Thinking about the $250,000 I blew on booze and other things in my whole life. Like, I think that's why I was so resistant in the beginning. You know, because you're saying I could have been getting this all this time for free? You know? But I have a life beyond my wildest dreams because of this program of action that's outlined in the 12 steps. And because I continually put my hand out, try to lay my life down for my brother and my sister, and I try to stay connected to God as possible through you. Thank you very much for your time.